Hello, and welcome to the Circle Squared podcast.
A safe place to make light of sacred things.
My name is Matt.
And I'm Corinne.
And on this program, we will discuss various topics and current events pertaining to religion, atheism, and skepticism. Our goal is not to insult believers,
although that will probably happen from time to time,
but rather to express our views on these issues in a way which may benefit and entertain others.
Or maybe we just want to stroke our own egos. You decide.
Hello, and welcome to the Circle Squared podcast. Today is Saturday, October 17th, 2015, and with me is my lovely wife, Corinne.
Hello.
Today we have a rather simple program planned for you. We will be discussing the most recent Mormon General Conference, which took place about 2 weeks ago. Before we get to that, if you would like to contact us, you can email us at circlesquaredpodcast@gmail.com. You can also view the show's blog at www.circlesquaredpodcast.blogspot.com and leave a comment there. If you like what you hear, please rate us and leave a review on whatever platform you find us. And without further ado, let's get started with the segment.
Okay. all right. So, yeah, conference was 2 weeks ago, so it's been a while, but there's just lots of stuff that happened in conference that just needs to be talked about, I think.
Yeah, it was a very interesting conference. Like, yeah. A lot of times I don't really pay that much attention to Mormon General Conference now that I'm not really involved in the church.
Now you don't have to watch it.
Right. I don't have the same obligation to pay attention to it that a lot of people around me do. Mm-hmm. But this conference, I don't know if it was just social media or what, but there was just tons of stuff that happened that, I mean, I didn't even listen to the talks, and like I was hearing all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah, yeah, and most of it was true, and that was the large reason why I wanted to actually like go through and read a bunch of these talks, because I wasn't sure how much of it was just people were implying things that didn't actually happen, or you know, so
right,
that was mostly
going to the source rather than listening to rumors.
Yeah,
right.
But for the most part, they were all pretty true.
Right.
So I know some of the bigger ones that circulated a lot were from Uchtdorf, a couple of his talks. He spoke three times, which is fairly unusual.
And Uchtdorf, for people that don't know, is the last name of a really high-up Mormon leader. I can never say his full name.
Dieter F.
Uchtdorf. He's from Germany or Austria?
Germany.
Yeah. Right, so he's become something of, the international poster child of Mormonism. Mormons like to think of themselves as an international religion, even though they're mostly localized here in Utah. Right, and in the States in general, I suppose, but mostly in Utah and some of the surrounding states. But they like to talk about how they're a growing world religion. And Dieter Uchtdorf.
DDA. Dieter.
Like, I can't say his name. I don't speak that language. Because he's from Germany, and he's so high up in the church's ranks, he's become the person that a lot of Mormons point to as saying, aha, see, we are international. We do accept other people. We are, you know, this and that. Mm-hmm. So, anyway.
Yeah. All right, so there was Uchtdorf, who talked a lot about skeptics. And then there was, let's see, was it Anderson? Yes, Anderson. Neil A. Anderson talked about giving Brother Joseph a break, which created a lot of fun memes to look at.
Uh-huh.
And then there were quite a few talks on mothers. So those are the ones that I mainly want to focus on.
Cool.
So I think we'll start with President Uchtdorf. This one specifically was from the priesthood session.
Mm-hmm. Priesthood session is the one that's just for men. So they don't allow any women to enter the conference center when this particular conference session is going on.
Right.
And the conference, I guess we haven't really talked about this, it's a semi-annual conference that they hold in Salt Lake City. So twice a year. They do it in April and October.
Mm-hmm. It's always the first week.
Right, the first weekend of October and April. And it's just like the way for the you know, the higher up leadership to talk to the general membership collectively. And so they televise it, they broadcast it. You can view it online in most areas. And they always print off transcripts, like in the next, you know, Ensign that comes out. The Ensign is their church publication. It's a magazine that they put out. So anyway, some background.
Okay. All right. So like I said, he spoke three times. He spoke the Saturday morning session, in the priesthood session, and in the women's conference session. His women's conference talk wasn't worth talking about. Mm-hmm. It's like one large story. Mm-hmm. But his priesthood one and the Saturday morning session they were very similar. Both along the same lines as, you know, skeptics and how you shouldn't listen to them, how they're, I don't know. Anyway.
Right, so it's kind of bashing the idea of exploring your doubts and asking too many questions.
Exactly.
Trying to discourage that kind of thought.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I want to start with his priesthood session one, even though it came after the Saturday morning session. But okay. So he starts off the priesthood session talk with the story of Daniel. This is Daniel that I think eventually ends up in the lion's den.
Okay.
But this part of the story is when he's taken from his city and taken to Babylon to serve King Nebuchadnezzar, mm-hmm. which is just a fun name.
Nebuchadnezzar.
Yeah. So in the story, from the city that Daniel is taken from and into Babylon, they both have different religions. But Daniel maintains his religious lifestyle despite being surrounded and pressured into trying to partake of like different things. While he's
which of course is something that Mormons identify with all the time.
Exactly.
Because they're like, they love the motto or the mantra, you know, you live in the world, but not of the world.
Is
that kind of idea.
Which is exactly what Daniel is doing.
Right.
And the big thing with this too, again, this is the priesthood session. And even though like adult men attend, I think it's really geared towards the adolescents. Mm-hmm. Especially this story, because he specifically says Daniel's age is somewhere between 12 and 17, mm-hmm. which are the exact ages of any, you know, Aaronic priesthood.
Youth.
Yeah, the youth. Anyway, so while Daniel is there, he's like studying and, you know, learning all these scholarly things. But the king has a dream that I guess really upsets him, and he wants his scholars and, you know, all of his magic men or whatever to interpret the dream, but none of them can interpret it, which is just
kind of silly
yeah. in and of itself. Because how do you really interpret a dream?
Similar to the story of Joseph in Egypt.
Yeah, exactly.
Hmm. Well, and this is a common
interpreting dreams is very common.
Right, it's a common theme in scripture in general. It happens a lot in the Book of Mormon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like Lehi's dream, like he took his family out of Jerusalem because he had a dream that Jerusalem would be destroyed.
Right.
Like this is a thing that is promoted in Mormon scripture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I don't necessarily remember what the dream was. Mm-hmm. He doesn't get into it at all. Uchtdorf doesn't.
Okay.
But none of his scholars can interpret the dream, which makes him so angry that he threatens to kill all of them, even like the apprentices and understudies, which would include Daniel and his friends that were taken from their city.
Okay.
But before that happens, Daniel like pleads with the king to let him interpret the dream. And wouldn't you know it, he is able to interpret the dream
and
saves everyone.
And do they say how the king was able to tell that Daniel's interpretation was the correct one?
I don't know. Maybe in the Bible they do, but in the story they don't.
It's
thinking too skeptically. Yeah, so anyways, just from the story alone, you get a lot of information. Again, the whole ages 12 to 17 is a very common tactic that the church uses.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime a young person is involved, they highlight the age and they direct it towards the youth. And it's their way of saying, look at what this young person did. This is what you should be doing. And it's like a mm-hmm. call to arms. It's like it's an attempt to make them rekindle their desire to be more righteous.
Right.
And it's so annoying.
Yeah. No,
Joseph is a very common example.
I remember like lots of talks and you know, Sunday school lessons and that kind of stuff growing mm-hmm. up. It was always about how special the youth were, how they were going to be this important
generation.
Yeah, chosen generation that were going to do all of these amazing mm-hmm. things to make it or set it up. Set up the world stage so that Jesus can come again.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah,
Yeah.
So very, very grandiose.
From what I hear, they've kind of tapered off talking about stuff like that. Like, this All is right. the generation. But I don't know. I mean, it's been in a year and a half since I've been to church, so I'm right. not entirely sure. But it still comes up every once in a while. It's just not a Zion's youth okay. sort of thing.
So they're trying to distance themselves probably yeah. from like the Mormon prepper
right.
group.
Exactly.
Which is a fun little subculture of Mormonism that's recently been kind of called out by church leadership as saying right. that they're crossing the line a little too much.
Mm-hmm.
Like trying to give like specific dates and things to events.
Right. Okay, so in the story, just the way Uchtdorf tells the story, I mean, I guess in the Bible it's kind of telling you the same thing, but how they say that the scholars can't interpret it. He's basically implying that anyone that's educated or, you know, is a mm-hmm. scholar, anyone with any kind of knowledge that isn't gospel-related mm-hmm. is second to the gospel. Like, there's no way they can...
Right.
They're just not that intelligent.
Scholarship is good, but only when it, mm-hmm. you know, reinforces spiritual things.
Exactly.
That's more or less what I gather is mm-hmm. the Mormon perception of education right now.
Yeah, and it just completely minimizes the effort of people that people take to, like, better their lives, to mm-hmm. learn things, to make other people's lives better. I don't know. It's annoying.
Yeah.
yeah. let's see. At one point, he just, like, point blank says that those who doubt are led to believe that they're sophisticated and intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
But he claims, obviously, with that statement that they're not. So, again, it's just mm-hmm. another blatant statement saying anyone that has any doubt has no mm-hmm. idea what they're doubting.
Right, just kind of undermining the whole concept.
Yeah, just undermines everything.
Mm-hmm.
He also talks about he talks about spiritual experiences and how they shouldn't be discounted, even though we can't always describe them in worldly terms. That's the phrase that he uses. And that is, yeah. again, a very common argument with,
right.
I mean, even people outside of Mormonism, like, it's they always use that. It's like, I can't explain it, but it happened. And it's just, it's just their way of saying that I experience something, therefore it's true,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't matter because I don't have to provide any proof to you. It happened to me, so it's true, and you should believe it. It's just...
Right. It's about as sound an argument as saying I believe because of faith.
Yeah.
In other words, they don't have a good reason.
Yeah.
You know.
uh-huh. Let's see. I want to read this quote.
Okay.
It's just after he talks about how. Satan suggests that the doubter and the skeptic and the cynic are sophisticated and intelligent. He says, Heavenly Father has prepared for his children a spiritual feast, offering every kind of exquisite food imaginable. And yet, instead of enjoying these spiritual gifts, the cynics content themselves with observing from a distance, sipping from their cups of skepticism, doubt, and disrespect. Which is just, I don't know. I don't even know what to say about that. But
it's insulting. Like,
yeah.
he's trying to insult people.
Mm-hmm. Both of his talks just are meant to insult anyone that is having a doubt.
Uh-huh. And wasn't it, it was a year ago, maybe a little bit longer, I can't remember, but it was Uchtdorf again, but he had that famous phrase, you know, doubt your doubts before
yeah.
you doubt your faith.
Mm-hmm.
And in that talk, if I remember correctly, he was a little bit more sympathetic to people that had concerns.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah, like he was saying like, you know, members should be understanding of other members when they're having doubts and concerns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't belittle them. Don't ostracize them. Like, try to be welcoming. Try to answer their questions, that kind
right.
of thing.
And that's, like, all he's doing in these talks.
Right. Like, so far, everything he said has just been belittling.
Yeah.
Just demeaning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's interesting about this little quote, though, is that it ties into Elder Ballard's talk. I'm not really going to talk about that one.
Okay.
But I think he had a talk maybe a year or so ago as well where he talks about the good ship Zion.
Oh, staying on the boat.
Staying on the boat,
one.
Yeah. It, which is just really similar to this whole spiritual feast thing. It's like,
don't venture too far.
We've got this massive, awesome yacht, and you're diving overboard to try and find your own way, even though you can't. Yeah, it's just...
Right.
Oh, it's just fun. So much fun.
Yeah. And I mean, I think an important part of this conversation, when we're talking about skepticism and asking questions and doubting
mm-hmm.
within the church, a big part of that is, and I believe that there was a talk that was about this explicitly, that, you know, the younger generation of Mormons right now, a lot of them are coming across websites on the internet that talk about these types of issues, and they're getting, you know, ideas in their heads and that kind of thing.
The internet comes up in like every other talk.
Does it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the church has, I think, noticed that this is, it is a problem for the church.
And it's not going to go away.
It's not going to go away. And and all of their attempts over decades, centuries really,
is being undone by the internet.
Exactly. Because they have this, like, this prettied up, whitewashed kind of version of their story, of their history, and of their scriptures. And all of it is being challenged on the internet. And it's and it's open to anybody. And anybody with, like, a smartphone or a tablet, which, you know, each year you get younger and younger kids having access to the internet. Like, they're coming across this stuff, and the church is scared. And for good reason. Because it literally is destroying their membership.
Let's see. There's another quote that I just thought was kind of funny and ridiculous. He says, "God is no respecter of persons. He is your father. He wants to speak to you. However, it requires a little scientific curiosity. It requires an experiment upon the word of God." Which I just think is super funny. It's like, it requires scientific curiosity, but...
So when I hear that kind of stuff, basically what that sounds like to me is that they want to minimize science, because science is the learning of men. But they also want to ride on the shoulders of science, because science has done so much for society. They want to borrow the authority that science has become in our society. But they don't want you to think too highly of science, because then you'll stop listening to what they have to say.
But I think the quote that, like, I know it upset you a lot too, Matt, was when he actually says that skepticism is easy.
That's one of the few bits that was actually quoted on the social media that I was paying attention to, and when I heard that, like, good grief.
And that was the reason that this quote was the main reason why I wanted to read this talk, because I was like, they don't usually come out and just say something like that. It's usually just subtly implied. They're very good at doing things like that. But Uchtdorf, throughout his entire thing, just point blank says things like this: skepticism is easy. And I mean, he goes on to say anyone can do it. And that, let's see, it is the faithful life that requires moral strength, dedication, and courage. Those who hold fast to faith are far more impressive than those who give in to doubt when mysterious questions or concerns arise. It's like completely demeaning. It's like a stab in the gut.
And the thing that drives me crazy is that he, you know, being as high up in the ranks of the church as he is, has to be aware or have had conversations with people who have had legitimate concerns and tried to, like, help them with them. Like, he knows that what he's saying is an insult.
I mean, this is one of the newer apostles that I kind of held some respect for. He was just fun to listen to. He wasn't old and just, like, drooping on the screen. Like, he was just fun to listen to. He always had some kind of airplane anecdote or whatever.
Well, he was in the Air Force or something, right?
Yeah, but I lost, like, all my respect for him with these talks, because he's just so condescending.
And one of the things that bothered me about this is that he's equating skepticism, which is, you know, withholding belief or withholding accepting an idea until you have sufficient evidence to support that idea.
Right.
Which is more or less the very basis of the scientific method. And he's equating that process with cynicism, which is basically just, you know, throwing everything out, throwing the baby out with the bathwater kind of idea, like, without regard to anything, and not taking consideration of, like, nuance and special considerations and that kind of stuff. And he's taking this extremely negative mentality, cynicism, and equating it to the scientific process. You know, it's an equivocation fallacy, really. Kind of drives me crazy.
I mean, that's basically the gist of his talk. It's just that skepticism is easy. Anyone can do it. Anyone who doubts is going the easy route.
Which, for anybody that's actually seriously looked into their doubts,
it is not easy.
It is not easy. No. And part of the hurdle that you have to go through is that a lot of the information that's out there that comes from the church isn't accurate.
Yeah.
And that's all that they want you to see. Mm-hmm. Like, they only want you to see what the church publishes. And if that's all you can see, you're not getting the full picture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's a way of them kind of monopolizing the information that's available. Right. And which is a lot easier to do with members.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the internet is making it a lot more difficult for them to hold on to that monopoly.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's basically his priesthood talk.
Okay.
So we'll move into his Saturday morning session talk, which again is very much along the same lines as the priesthood session. He starts off this time with an anecdote of when he got surgery at some point. He doesn't go into details about what the surgery was on. But after the surgery, his doctors gave him a longer recovery time than he had anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't happy with that. And so he went home and he got right on the internet and started searching for like other ways to maybe like speed up the process or to see if maybe they were withholding information like that would, you know, it's just okay. Silly. And obviously you can tell where this is going, right?
Right.
Yeah. So he says that when he's on the internet looking for all these things, and then he just stops and he just kind of laughs at himself because he realizes that he's doing the same thing that people that are skeptical of the church are doing. Basically,
that is ludicrous.
Yeah. Yeah,
that is a ridiculous example.
Yeah,
that's
because completely different.
It's completely different because with the church you're making the assumption based on faith, again, not on evidence,
right,
that these men Uchtdorf and his cronies are authorities on spiritual matters.
Yep.
Okay, and they're basing this off of, you know, the feelings of the spirit, or like, you know, the burning of the bosom kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like those are the things that they are basing this assumption on, that these men know what they're talking about.
Right.
And they're equating that to doctors who spend years and years and years studying evidence that has been accumulated over centuries.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not the same thing.
They're not the same thing. But at the same time, like, doctors will tell you all the time to seek a second opinion.
Right.
They never just say, no, this is the only way it can be done. Any way that anyone else tells you is wrong. This is the only way. They don't do that.
There's
they encourage you to look things up on the internet to find other ways to make yourself healthier.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it just, the church's stance on not searching the internet for anything just doesn't match up with reality now.
No.
Because you use the internet to search for everything, for second opinions on everything. You look at the internet for like reviews on where to eat. Like, it comes down to that. Like, the reality of today is that we use it for everything.
Exactly.
And to say you can't use it for the church just is, like, a huge red flag.
Yeah, it's them really showing their true colors,
yeah.
I think.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. He goes on later to say that we need to ask the right questions.
In other words, questions that they say are okay.
Right. And I want to read you the questions that he lists
off. Oh, he gives examples.
Uh-huh. Good. So the first question is, does my life have meaning? Which, I mean,
it's a bit nebulous.
It's nebulous, but it is kind of a question that people even outside of the church will ask, you know,
and
outside
even provide
of religion.
Answers for.
Yeah, and providing answers for. It's like, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So after you ask that question, the second question is, do I believe in God?
Okay.
And with the problem with this question, as soon as you answer no, you can't move on to any of the other questions.
Right.
Because they all revolve around the answer to this one. The third question is, do I believe that God knows and loves me? Fourth one is, do I believe that God hears and answers my prayers?
So these are just the most basic, mundane questions.
Yep.
Like, these aren't the sort of things that are causing people to question the veracity of the Book of Mormon.
No.
Or the church leadership or anything like that.
Yeah.
These are like the most basic mm-hmm. of basic questions.
The next question is, am I truly happy? Which is what it all comes down to. It's like, if you're happy in the church, then it's true.
Then just leave well enough alone.
Yeah, exactly. Don't look for anything else.
Right.
You're fine.
Which to a certain extent I would be fine with, except that the church you know, takes 10% of your money, plus offerings.
Mm-hmm. And they require so much of your time.
They require your entire life, really.
Yeah.
It's like they're not just asking you to live in the church and be happy.
No.
They're asking for you to contribute time and resources, and a lot of them.
And a lot of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. The last question is, are my efforts leading me to the highest spiritual goals and values in life?
These are just ridiculous questions.
And they're not questions that if you're skeptical about religion, any religion in general, these aren't the questions you ask.
Right.
Because obviously the answers to these are probably no.
Right. And the interesting thing is that, you know, we mentioned briefly on the last episode, the revelation of the Seer Stone that happened a couple months ago. And, you know, we mentioned the Ensign, the church's magazine publication that they put out every month. And I think it's this month they're supposed to have an article on the Seer Stone.
Right.
And so, like, they know that this is an issue, that this is, you know, the type of thing that is going to ruffle some feathers. It's going to get people asking questions because it doesn't line up with what the church has been saying.
Yeah, right. Since primary.
Like, for years and years and years, they've been telling one story, and now we're hearing a different story. Mm-hmm. Okay.
They're trying to mix together.
Right.
They're trying to make it the same story.
Right, and act like nothing's changed, which is just kind of silly.
Yeah.
You know, and they didn't even address those kinds of issues.
Nope.
But they're talking about, like, you know, skepticism and avoiding the internet and getting answers only from the church. Well, what is the church saying about the Seer Stone, really? Mm-hmm. It's always been here. It's not our fault that you didn't know that it was here. It's not our fault that artists that were published in church publications didn't depict it accurately. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, how are you, how is the church actually going to resolve any of these concerns with their current tactics? Mm-hmm. They're just not.
Right.
They're going to raise more questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's see. So a big part of this talk was just simplifying.
Okay.
See, at first he says, let's see, quote, "Sometimes the truth may just seem too straightforward, too plain, and too simple for us to fully appreciate its great value." And then later he says, "This beautiful gospel is so simple a child can grasp it, yet so profound and complex that it will take a lifetime, even an eternity, of study and discovery to fully understand it." Oh, and, you know, I mean, this is pretty common in the church, too. You hear this all the time. Mm-hmm. But what I find funny about this, and this is the reason why I kind of wanted to bring this up, but, like, it's not simple. Like,
right.
I was a Sunbeam teacher, so I taught the, 3 to 5-year-old kids, and there are, like, a lot of the lessons are just kind of silly. But there are some things that they can't grasp. And one of the big ones is the Holy Ghost, and the other one is Heavenly Father as your Father. Like, try explaining those to a child. They don't understand it. And
that's interesting.
Yeah. Those were two of the hardest lessons I had to give because I had no answers. Like, how do you explain a good ghost to little children?
Right.
And then how do you tell them that their real father is in heaven, their earthly father is just kind of a stand-in?
Right.
They don't understand it. It's like, no, this is my daddy. Like,
those are extremely complex, abstract ideas.
Exactly. It's not simple.
Right. And it kind of reminds me, we've been listening to the My Book of Mormon podcast, which, for, you know, people that aren't aware, it's kind of a fantastic idea. You have this guy who was never a part of the Mormon Church at all. He just decided one day that he was going to read the Book of Mormon from cover to cover and do a podcast, just basically saying what his impressions are of the book.
As he's reading.
Just reading it at face value, right? And he's reading this, you know, we're 20 episodes in, something like that.
Yeah, we're somewhere in Mosiah,
which is getting towards some of the more boring parts of the book. But for, you know, the first few episodes, you know, you have Nephi, like one of the first authors in the Book of Mormon, saying over and over again how plain and simple the gospel is, and all of these plain and precious truths. And he's reading this.
And how he's speaking plainly.
Right, he's speaking plainly. And this guy, what's his name, David Michael?
Mm-hmm.
He's reading this, and his impression is like,
No, what?
Like, this isn't plain.
I don't get what's going on.
I have no idea what's being said.
Yeah.
It's like, and they present it as if, you know, this is a given, that it's a plain and simple idea.
Yeah.
But it's not. And you don't even get the real core of gospel doctrine, really, from the Book of Mormon. You get it all from Doctrine and Covenants, which is all just, you know, the ramblings of Joseph Smith after he had established the church anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, the Book of Mormon doesn't even come into account for most of it.
Right. But, like, the whole plain and simple truths thing just plays into the church's tactic of, if you don't understand it, it's your fault. Right. It is so simple that a child can grasp it. If you're an adult and you don't understand what's going on, you've got to fix something.
Right.
Like, something is wrong with you. You've done something in your life mm-hmm. that is preventing you from understanding it.
Which is the exact, you know, excuse that they use whenever somebody prays about the Book of Mormon,
yeah.
which they're told that they're supposed to, right? Mm-hmm. You get to the end of the Book of Mormon, and it has Moroni's promise. It says, if you pray about it, God will give you an answer telling you that mm-hmm. the Book of Mormon is true.
Right? Yeah.
And that means that Mormonism is true. And if you do that and then you don't get an answer, you don't get this, you know, powerful sensation, this burning in your bosom, then, I mean, if you were following a skeptic's process, you know, the scientific method, that would mean that you didn't get an answer from God, therefore it's not true.
Right.
But the church will say, oh, but you weren't really sincere.
Yeah.
Or God is testing you.
You didn't ask in the right way.
You didn't ask in the right way. You know, it's always about how you did something wrong.
Right.
And you have to keep trying, right. keep doing it over and over again. And I, you know, in my experience with that, I tried it off and on for the better part of a decade.
Yeah.
Before I really started, like, getting into my doubts and stuff. And as I was getting into my doubts, I realized, oh, wait, that doesn't make any sense. Like, I haven't received an answer, not because I've done something wrong. I haven't gotten an answer because there isn't an answer to get, at least not from the source that they're telling me.
Right, exactly.
Anyway. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's all about victimizing the individual and never having the church take accountability.
Yeah, yep. Mm-hmm. So the basic point of that entire talk was ask the right questions. Mm-hmm. And if the church seems too complicated, you need to simplify. No, that was the basic gist of his talk.
So more just condescension and uh-huh. yeah, patronizing.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so let's move on to Brother Anderson's talk.
Okay. Brother Anderson.
I guess it's Elder Anderson still.
I'll be honest, whenever I hear his name, Neil A. Anderson, mm-hmm. I always think of The Matrix.
Why?
Because the main character, Neo. His real name is his last name is Anderson. And so, like, the main, like, agent in the funny. Matrix is always calling him Mr. Anderson or whatever it is.
Oh, that's funny.
However he says it. I can't do the voice right.
Yeah.
But
and Neil sounds reminiscent of Neo.
Right.
That's awesome. I never thought of that.
So that's always where my mind goes when I hear his name.
Oh, that's great.
Mr. Anderson.
All right. So, Mr. Anderson's talk, again, it follows the same lines as Uchtdorf's talk. It's, again, about being skeptical and not immersing yourself in doubts and stuff.
Okay.
let's see. His one quote that I guess I have a couple quotes that I want to read. But this first one, he says, immersing oneself in persistent doubt, fueled by answers from the faithless and the unfaithful, weakens one's faith in Jesus Christ and the restoration. I mean, that follows with Uchtdorf's. It's like, if you're looking for outside sources mm-hmm. from people that don't believe the same things that you're supposed to believe,
right.
It's your fault. You're immersing yourself in all of these bad things.
Right.
It's the whole negative influence pitch that they like to throw out at you every once in a while in church.
Right.
Yeah. But, I mean, the big thing about Anderson's talk was his give Brother Joseph a break. And he's gotten a lot of flack for that.
So one of the things that's so funny about this
mm-hmm.
Is manifest in an example that happened on Reddit like the next day, right?
It was like as soon as he said it, all of these memes came up.
Right, so... So there were the memes, but I'm talking about a specific individual that was on Reddit.
Uh-huh.
He was listening to the talk, and he's like, "Give Joseph a break. Give Brother Joseph a break." Uh-huh. And this is a man that was raised in the church. I don't know how old he is, but you know he's an adult, and he was like, "Wait, give him a break for what?"
Exactly. Like, it just raises more questions for people.
He had no idea that there were these issues. Mm-hmm. And so he started doing research.
I remember you showed me the story.
Right. It's on Reddit. Uh-huh. I forget the gentleman's name, like his handle, uh-huh. on Reddit handle or whatever. But if you go to the ex-Mormon Reddit and like dig through the archives, you know, to like 2 weeks ago, you'll find it.
Mm-hmm.
This gentleman started digging into church history because of this talk. Because yep. when Neil Anderson said, "Give Joseph a break," he was like, give him a break for what? And it sent him down this rabbit hole. Uh-huh. And he found all of this information that was being withheld from him.
Right. And I think he even said he started on LDS.org and he wasn't getting like right. any, he wasn't making headway with it. Right. And that's when he branched out.
Right. Because if you only stick to church approved sources, uh-huh. you'll never get the answer.
Exactly.
And that's what they want.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that poor guy.
Yeah, poor guy. Seriously. Like yeah. having his whole world rocked mm-hmm. over a weekend. Mm-hmm. Good grief.
Yeah. And the whole give Brother Joseph a break thing, I thought maybe people had taken liberties or something with that and just mm-hmm. kind of condensed it into that phrase. But no, he actually says give Brother Joseph a break.
Right.
But I want to read this paragraph to you where he actually says it. So he starts out, "For example, questions concerning the prophet Joseph Smith are not new. They have been hurled by his critics since this work began. To those of faith who, looking through the colored glasses of the 21st century, honestly question events or statements of the prophet Joseph from nearly 200 years ago, may I share some friendly advice. For now, give Brother Joseph a break. In a future day, you will have 100 times more information than from all today's search engines combined, and it will come from our all-knowing heaven, Father in Heaven. Consider the totality of Joseph's life. Born in poverty and given little formal education, he translated the Book of Mormon in less than 90 days. Tens of thousands of honest, devoted men and women embraced the cause of the Restoration. At age 38, Joseph sealed his witness with his blood. I testify that Joseph Smith was a prophet of God. Settle this in your mind and move forward." So there are just so many problems with just that paragraph alone.
Right.
I mean, he starts off by saying you're looking through colored glasses.
Which to a certain extent I agree with. Like uh-huh. I remember when I first heard about how a lot of the founding fathers had slaves, mm-hmm. right? Like Thomas Jefferson mm-hmm. and a couple other guys had slaves, and how a lot of people when they hear that think, oh my gosh, like how terrible that they had slaves and stuff. And yes, it is terrible that they had slaves, mm-hmm. and it was wrong. It was morally wrong for them to do that. But you know, people always say like, well, you got to look at it from you know, the perspective of like the times mm-hmm. and that kind of stuff. And if that was the kind of thing that we were talking about with Brother Joseph,
right.
I probably wouldn't even have a problem with him saying that.
Exactly.
But what we're talking about is manipulation, mm-hmm. coercion. Mm-hmm. Like he tricked 14-year-old girls into marrying him.
Yeah.
By threatening them, telling them as a prophet of God, saying, if you don't marry me, or if you tell anybody that you've married me, then your whole family will be damned.
Yeah.
Okay. That's the kind of sick stuff that Joseph did. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of stuff that Neil Anderson is saying to just give him a pass on.
Exactly.
Because it was 200 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, I'm sorry, but that kind of thing, it's too much.
Right. And just, I mean, the whole phrase, colored glasses, like, it automatically, like, tells his listeners mm-hmm. that everything is false.
Well, it's kind of implying that they're succumbing to their own bias.
Right.
Which,
okay, yeah.
Which if you turn it around on them, mm-hmm. He's giving Brother Joseph too much of a break. He's looking at it from the perspective that the church is true, therefore mm-hmm. there must be a reasonable explanation. He must have been doing this because God told him to.
Yeah.
And he's looking at it through his own colored glasses.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. There are colored glasses on yeah. both sides.
Right, which is fine. Like, you can't completely eliminate bias. Right. But just looking at the facts which the church tried to cover up, mm-hmm. Joseph was a bit of a scoundrel.
Yeah.
Putting it nicely.
Yeah.
I almost said a bad word.
Right. And just, I don't know, it's just funny because it goes along with the fellow on Reddit that was like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Give him a break for what? It's like, just saying give him a break implies that he did something wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, again, it's a red flag. It's like, why do we need to give someone a break that is supposedly like this, you know, prophet, this right. man of God? It's like, we shouldn't need to give someone like that a break.
Right. And he wasn't even just doing things that were just part of the culture.
No.
Like these were way past culture.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But what kind of frustrates me with this give Brother Joseph a break thing is the, I talked about it in the last episode about if you pray about the Book of Mormon, mm-hmm. if you get a confirming answer, then Joseph Smith is a true prophet and the church is true.
Right.
But if any one of those turns out to be untrue or your faith is shaken on those at all, everything else crumbles.
Right. It's
and that's the whole thing with, giving him a break. It's like, we can't give him a break because it's so intertwined with this whole, the Book of Mormon is true and the church is true. If you are shaken at all on Joseph, then everything else falls away. And they know that, but at the same time, it's like, we can't just give him a break. These things need to be looked into.
Exactly. It's more just discouraging people from looking into the facts and just accepting the story and the narrative that the church has been producing.
Right. Yeah, that was the big thing that I wanted to talk about with Anderson. He also had a story that he started out with, which is pretty typical of most of these talks, but it's not really... I didn't think it was very relevant to the whole give a brother Joseph a break. So I don't think I'll go into it. But yeah, just know there was a story.
There was a story.
All right, now for the fun stuff.
Okay.
Well, the other stuff was fun too, but... All right, so we have lots of talks on women and mothers. Obviously, there was a women's conference, so it's a pretty, it's pretty much a surefire thing that all of the talks are going to have something to do with womanhood.
Okay.
And they all did. But I don't even really, I mean, a couple of them I'll talk about a little bit. But the two big ones were from Russell M. Nelson and from Holland. I totally just spaced his other his name.
Jeffrey R. Holland.
Yes, that's the one.
Whom I've met.
Oh.
I ran into him, actually, coming out of a restroom in Eastern Europe.
Oh, that's so funny. That is completely random.
I'm just saying, it happened.
Okay. So, women in the church. So, just... The talks throughout the ages about women in the church are just there mainly to bolster the women in church. They just want to uplift the women's place in a church. And they drive home the idea of motherhood being a divine role all the time. That is just...
Right, which to me, and I'm sure like it's similar for you, it seems, or it comes across as a bit of compensation for the fact that women don't have any real leadership in the church.
Yeah,
it's like, you can't be leaders in the church. Like, you can't be an apostle. You can't be like Jeffrey Holland or Uchtdorf or Anderson. Like, you can't be like them, but you get to be a mom.
Exactly.
And they want to equate those things.
Compensation. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
This is how they say the women are equal to men, because they get to be moms and men can't.
Right.
It's just infuriating. I actually did a blog post about this whole divine nature thing on my blog, but I was going to look that up and read some stuff, but I forgot, so I'm not going to.
That's all right.
Okay, so I'm going to start with...
We're actually running a little long already, but we're good.
Well, I'm still going.
Go.
Okay, so I'm going to start off with the primary general president. Her name is Rosemary Wixom. She spoke about discovering the divinity within. So there's that word. They love to throw the word divine around. She doesn't bring up anything that hasn't been said before in previous conferences. It's all just reiteration.
Okay.
I mean, none of the speakers really do. But she quotes...
That's kind of the way conference goes in general anyways.
In general, yeah. But especially with talks about women. I think, but I could just be a little biased being a woman.
Right. There's those colored glasses.
Yeah. So she quotes a former Young Women president, Elaine Cannon, who said that there are two important days in a woman's life, the day she is born and the day she finds out why.
It's like a line from like a chick flick.
Yeah, exactly. But the day you were born is important because, wow, you have life. But the day you find out why, what day do you think that is?
A specific day? I don't know. Like, assuming that a person does the whole Moroni promise thing, like, we keep going back to that. Let's say that they do actually get something like an answer. Like, that day could be a specific day.
No.
Oh, not even close.
You're not even thinking like a woman. Come on, Matthew.
As much as I try. Okay.
So there are two options that I think that this could be referring to. And they're both kind of intertwined. The first one would be realizing that being a mother is an important thing.
Okay.
It's like, coming to the conclusion that this is your role in life. You accept it or whatever, which could happen in like young women's. Okay. The second would be the day you become a mother, which is kind of what I'm more or less leaning to. But I mean, they're intertwined. It all has to do with motherhood. It's being a mother. That is the second most important day in your life.
Being a mother.
Yeah. Right. Becoming a mother. Uh-huh. Finding out you're going to be a mother. Something like that. Deciding you want to be a mother. Which is just, I hate it.
They're conflating
it. I hate
them.
It. I mean, well, they're conflating it, but it's like, it's bad. All you're good for.
Right. It's not that being a mom is bad. It's not like it's, you know, isn't a great thing. Like, it is a great thing.
Right.
But they're conflating it to this point where it's like this divine, God-given calling. Mm-hmm. Like, it's this super extra special thing.
Yeah.
To make them, you know, not question why they can't be leaders in the church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if it's so special, why is it half the population that gets to do it?
Right.
I don't know.
I mean, I understand that, like, the whole, like, pregnancy thing, birthing thing, being a mother thing, it is a special thing.
Yes.
But it does not make your place equal in the church. And that right. is what drives me crazy, because so many women in the church, women that I've been surrounded with my entire life, accept it. It's like, yes, I am equal to a man. It's like, no, you are not equal.
Right.
You are not equal until you are up on that stand, like, making decisions exactly. and preaching and doing things like that.
Like, I mean, could you imagine in, like, the women's suffrage movement, you know, a century ago, if there were women standing in front of, like, these rallies saying, you know what? We get to be mothers. We don't need the right to vote.
Oh, I'm sure that happened. I have no doubt that happened.
Right. It's like they're completely missing the point. Like, the two are not the same.
No.
They're not equal.
Yeah. Being a mother doesn't mean... I don't know. It's just infuriating.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, a woman's role on the earth is just to further the plan of salvation. And how does she do that? She becomes a mother.
Right.
And, you know, that's basically what she's saying. Let's see. She goes further by saying that our divine nature has nothing to do with our personal accomplishments. Our divine nature comes from God. And this phrase kind of frustrated me as well, because it's just, it's minimizing anything you accomplish outside of the home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're a successful businesswoman. Yeah. Or even just any hobbies that you do outside of the home.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're a phenomenal scrapbooker, that's okay, because you're usually scrapbooking family things.
Right.
But, like, being a marathon runner or, you know, being a career woman, doing, I don't know, I can't even come up with anything else.
Right.
But just anything that happens outside of your home that does not revolve around the family is minimized. It's not important.
Right.
Which is completely false. Like, it is so important. It's important to your character. It's important to how you move throughout your life. And it reflects on how you, like, raise your children and stuff. Like, it's all intertwined, but they're separating it and minimizing it.
Mm. Being a housewife is not the same thing as being well-rounded.
No. No. And there are so many examples, I'm sure, in both of our lives that we can just think of that, like, they're not well-rounded. They're not...
Right. They're focused on a single facet of their life. And
yeah.
That becomes their focus.
Yeah.
And
as soon as the children are gone, it's like they're bereft.
Exactly.
It's like, what do I do now?
Like, that's why so many people have, what's the phrase? Empty nest syndrome.
Yeah, empty nest
depression,
syndrome. Yeah.
Depression, something along those lines. Like, it's a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just as real as, you know, when, what's that other phrase? Is it postpartum?
Postpartum.
Yeah, when mother gives
after
birth.
They have, yeah.
Yeah. Like these are real things. These are real emotions that people have, and it's all based around the idea that they're a mom, you know?
Right. Well, postpartum depression is definitely different than empty nester.
Yes. I'm not exactly sure where I'm going with this.
Yeah. We'll just leave postpartum depression out of it.
Right.
That is a legitimate thing.
Right.
It has nothing to do with the church.
Well, so is empty nester, but still.
Anyway. Right, but that's caused, like, from... like this whole revolving everything revolves around my children. You know what I'm saying? Like,
it's the mentality of this is your whole life.
Yeah.
And now that aspect of your life is gone, what do you do?
What do you do? Okay. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's what I was getting at. Okay. And then later on in the talk, Wixom says, she talks about how we serve because of our divine nature. Which basically just implies that the only reason people serve others is because of God's influence in our lives. Which is just kind of frustrating, too, because it's just implying that anyone without God in their lives doesn't serve It's just that whole angry atheist thing. Mm-hmm. It's the whole you have no morality because you don't have God kind of thing.
Right, which is kind of silly because when you think about it, helping somebody for the sake of helping that person, to me, is a more moral reason to help somebody mm-hmm. than helping somebody because
you're going to get something from God.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Like, I agree.
Because that seems a bit self-serving to me.
It is.
It's like
I'm completely self-serving.
Yeah, I'm helping you so that I can get a couple more notches on my belt that'll help me get into a higher place in heaven. Mm-hmm. Or if you're more of a mainstream Christian, avoid hell.
Yes.
You know? Mm-hmm. It's like just helping people for the sake of helping them, like, you know, giving them relief in some way. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a good thing. That's a moral thing. Right. It's reducing pain, mm-hmm. you know, and that should be the motivation. It's humanism. Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's the humanist movement.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So that's all I wanted to talk about with her talk. We'll go with the first counselor in the Young Women's General Presidency, whose name is Carol F. McConkie. McConkie. I'm sure that name is familiar to you.
Yeah. Yeah, Bruce R. McConkie was a big name in Mormonism a couple decades ago. Mm-hmm. He wrote a fun little book called Mormon Doctrine.
That the church doesn't like to use anymore.
That the church doesn't like to use now. At the time, it was very popular. Mm-hmm. They've distanced themselves now because he says a lot of things that now are considered to be kind of backwards,
right?
Like socially, generally. Mm-hmm. He came out and said that blacks should never get the priesthood. They never will get the priesthood. A few things along those lines, like made a few racist comments. I don't know if he ever said anything about homosexuality.
I want to say that I looked in my parents' copy for homosexuality and I didn't find anything.
Yeah, that seems to be more of a it a was more just recent
yeah anything issue. It was like written in there, but it said see like sexual sin or chastity.
So it's just kind of lumped in.
Yeah, it's just lumped in with everything else.
Right. But he said some things about blacks that were pretty racist. And so now the church is distancing themselves from his work.
Yeah.
So I assume this is what his daughter?
Maybe. I didn't look into it, but she's definitely related. Yeah. The church,
McConkie is a name that you know.
Yeah.
In Mormon.
The church, despite being saying that people are called of God, is still like they like to follow pure bloodlines. So you'll find recurring names all the time in the presidencies and higher ups mm-hmm. all the time. Okay. Anyway, so I just want to point out that I think it started last year, but they started allowing 8-year-old girls to attend Young Women's.
Okay.
I mean, not Young Women's, Women's Conference.
Right.
Which
normally
weird.
The cutoff was 12?
Yeah, it's as soon as you are a young woman, you can, which is 12.
So they lowered it from 12 to 8.
To 8. Okay. Which they didn't do in the priesthood session. I'm just throwing that out there. Because the women don't have anything special like the priest did. Mm-hmm. But keep that in mind, that there are 8-year-old girls listening to this talk.
Okay.
She says outright that the most important work we can do is to prepare for marriage and family.
To an 8-year-old girl.
To an 8-year-old girl. Huh. I mean, even to a 12-year-old, 13-year-old, 14-year-old, on up through the spectrum. Like, it's not the kind of message I think that you should be giving young women. Like, this is what the church tells young women.
Right.
They say education is fine, but only to the extent as it doesn't interfere with getting married and having a family.
Right. Just like education is fine as long as it doesn't get you asking too many questions about the church history.
Right. I mean, she is saying that the main goal in a girl's life is to get married and to have babies. And this means that hobbies and education and any other like dreams a little girl might have are secondary.
Right.
They are not the priority. Mm-hmm. And it's damaging. Like, it makes women in general, I think, less ambitious. It's like they don't want to pursue anything else because they are supposed to be mothers.
Right.
And it hurts them. It hurts them in the future, especially because lots of girls just end up not getting married. For one
right,
reason or
which
another.
Which is a growing problem in the church.
It is a growing problem in the church. There are lots of, like, older women. And I say older kind of tongue-in-cheek because it's usually, like, 30-year-old
yeah.
woman that's not married. But as soon as you hit 21, you're practically spinster and unmarriageable.
Uh-huh.
That's just the way it goes in the church right now.
It's kind of a cultural thing.
It's definitely a cultural thing. And it might be more of just in Utah, that's a huge thing. But anyway, yeah, I don't know. It's just so harmful because, like, an individual person needs to be self-sufficient and be able to stand on their own. And right. That's just the way the world is moving.
Right.
You know, people are living longer, living more solitary lives in a way, like, they're just more independent. And telling a girl that she needs to get married and have babies just automatically makes her dependent.
Exactly. Like, it forces them into dependence.
Yeah.
Like men, if they don't get married, like, they're kind of frowned upon in the church or whatever, but they can, you know, still move up in the church ranks a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
With women, if they're not married, like they hit dead ends a lot sooner than the guys do.
Yeah.
And then if they do get married, at the expense of, say, getting a proper education, where if they were to become independent again,
mm-hmm.
like, if through a divorce or a death or something along those lines, I know people that are in the situation where now they are no longer married, they have a few kids, and they never finish their degree.
What do they do? Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
it's like how are you going to support the kids?
Right.
How are you going to support yourself?
Mm-hmm.
It's like they have become economically dependent on a man
yep.
to keep them alive, essentially.
Yeah. This was actually, this whole, like, concept of getting married and having children is one of the things that, there was a lady in, I can't remember if she was in the Relief Society General Presidency or the Young Women's General Presidency. I think it was Relief Society Presidency, and I can't remember her name right now, but she wasn't married. I know Sherry Dew isn't, no, Sherry Dew isn't married either, but this is another lady. The time, I didn't know Sherry Dew wasn't married.
Okay.
This lady, though, like, she gave a talk about, again, it revolved around being a woman in the church, mothering and stuff. And this single woman gets up and starts talking about how, like, you can, even if you don't get married and you don't have children or whatever, you can still be a mother to other people. That was, I think, more or less the gist of it. But I remember thinking, like, this woman, like, she holds some kind of an office, quote unquote, in the church,
mm-hmm.
but she can never reach the highest degree of glory because she is not married.
Oh,
and
that's true.
That's the first time I really thought about that, and, like, it crushed me inside, because, like, this was a good woman
mm-hmm.
who's not going to be able to reach the highest degree of glory, but she's still giving all of her time,
right.
everything to this church, and I couldn't understand that.
Right.
I don't know. It how still
they
blows my mind.
They have to be married in order to get
yeah.
married. Yeah.
And I actually brought that up to my mom when she asked me where my testimony stood or whatever. And that was one of the things I talked about. And she was like, well, you know, she'll be taken care of. We're told that single women will be taken care of.
And,
it's like,
and what that means is they will get put with a guy, probably
right.
in a polygamous
yeah.
relationship.
Yeah, you'll
in
have
heaven.
A spiritual marriage and you'll be in a polygamous marriage.
You'll be in
yeah.
a polygamous marriage in heaven.
Yeah.
That's your compensation.
Yeah, for not being married on earth.
Yeah.
I mean, and even if that wasn't the case, it's still, she can still get into the celestial kingdom. It's
just
like,
not the highest
but,
degree.
Yeah, she can't get in the highest degree.
Right.
She can't be her own goddess.
Right.
She cannot create her own worlds.
Right.
She has to have a man.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was a bit of a diversion. So now we'll go into the Relief Society General President, Melinda
okay.
Reeves, and her talk is very similar to both of Uchtdorf's talks, and
okay.
she talks about the internet and social media being tools of Satan.
I just hope that she actually says that.
I can look through it and see. I can't remember off the top
okay.
of my head.
That's
I didn't
fine.
Write the quote down.
I'm just going to let that kind of wallow in my mind as you say this.
But I'm pretty sure she actually said something pretty close to that. That's why I wrote it down.
A tool of Satan.
Right.
<That's> awesome.
Anyway, so she says, and this part is a quote, many in today's world are looking for instant gratification and instant knowledge on the internet. In contrast, we will be exceedingly blessed if we exercise faith and patience and go to our Heavenly Father, the source of all truth, with our concerns. Yeah.
Just more of the same, really.
Just more of the same.
It's like,
yeah.
Don't go to the internet. Internet's bad.
Yeah.
Just stick with the church's narrative.
Mm-hmm.
The church gives you all the information you need.
Right. And, like, instant gratification and instant knowledge, I think, are a bit of a stretch. I mean, it is
right.
a lot faster to find something out now. You don't have to go pouring through books.
Right. But if you want to do proper research,
instant.
Right, if you want to do proper research,
you verify,
you still have to
you
verify.
Double check,
yeah.
you look through other
you look
sources.
At original sources.
Like, it can take a long time.
Mm-hmm. It goes back to the whole idea that skepticism is easy.
Exactly.
Skepticism
it's not easy.
It's not easy.
It's not instant gratification. Mm-mm. It's not instant knowledge.
It's a process.
It's so much of a process. Yeah. All right. That's the only thing I wanted to talk about with hers. Okay. Just the...
Cool.
So now we'll go into Nelson.
And this is another apostle.
Yes.
So.
Yes. So he talked about women... Okay, so first why I wanted to read his was because another meme was going around with him. It wasn't like a negative meme. It was like a meme that I think the church probably put out. It was a quote. Mm-hmm. He tells a story in there briefly about he's a heart surgeon and a pretty good heart surgeon.
Yeah.
And he talks about this one family in specific that had like just a genetic heart problem. All of their kids... Mm-hmm. That he talked about anyway had this problem. So like their oldest had this problem and he operates on him or her. I don't remember. but the operation doesn't work. The child dies. They come in like 6 months later or something with another child that has the same heart problem and he does another procedure trying to save this child. It doesn't work. He goes through like three of their children, I think, and all three of them don't survive.
Wow.
Yeah, it's some really bad heart problem.
Pretty bad story.
Yeah, it is a pretty bad story. And it's heartbreaking and it's sad or whatever.
Uh-huh.
But he says that after like this last one, he just goes home and he just collapses on the floor and he just weeps, you know.
Hmm.
I mean, he just experienced in the last like year, three really terrible deaths. He's gotten close to the family because they've been there throughout the entire thing, you know. But his wife, I guess, came in, his first wife, came in and talked and like comforted him or whatever and just said at the end, I'm going to butcher the quote, but she basically says, stop crying. Now is not the time. You have work to do. That's basically what the quote says. So,
buck up.
Yeah, buck up. And I just wanted to read the talk because I don't know. It was just interesting.
Right.
Anyway, so he talks about women of this specific dispensation being distinct from any other, which again is a very common tactic.
Right.
And it plays into the whole, special. This is the chosen generation.
Right.
But it's still a little more subtle than it has been in the past. And it's just, you know, trying to inspire women to recommit to the gospel and to their role in the gospel. Let's see. So he offers up the platitude that the brethren need a woman's strength, conversion, conviction, ability to lead, wisdom, and voices to bolster them, basically.
Right.
Which I get really tired of hearing this all the time.
You're an helpmeet.
Yeah, you're a helpmeet. Like, let the men do the heavy lifting. Uh-huh. You're just there for moral support.
You're a cheerleader.
Yeah. Yeah. A woman's role in the church is to be a cheerleader.
Don't bother being the heart surgeon. Just encourage
the heart surgeon. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. But one thing that this called to mind was a lot of the times, like, in my experience anyway, whenever a new bishop is called or even a stake president, I mean, it's usually a bishop, but the stake president will come in on the day when they're like telling everyone that this is going to be the new bishop, that their process is to find the most righteous, most humble, like basically the best church member there is in the ward.
Mm.
And then he ends that by saying, and then I call her husband.
Uh-oh.
Which just, it's like, which I don't understand. Yeah, it's a bait and switch. It's like, I'm looking for this super humble, super righteous person, but I'm going to call her husband. It's like, if she is so humble, so righteous, so perfect, why can't she be the bishop?
Yeah.
And that was a thought I had very early on. It's like, that doesn't make any sense. How does that make the woman feel good?
Yeah, and how does that make the husband feel good?
Right.
But I guess the husband gets to be
the husband gets to be the bishop. Which, I mean, you could argue being the bishop is not the funnest job in the world because you get a lot of crap.
Right. It's
but
not.
Still, it's a leadership position, and that's that's the big focus.
Right.
Yeah. So basically, women in the church are just in the background. Like you said, they're cheerleaders. They just get lost.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see.
They're baby-making cheerleaders.
Yep, they're baby-making cheerleaders. They're just around for support and not for actual leadership. Which is also funny because recently they came out and said that three women were being placed in three of the highest church offices. I can't remember them all off the top of my head, but one has to do with missions.
Okay.
It's like a council, missionary council. And then another one has to do with like family and genealogy. Family history, and the other one has to do with like family and I can't remember. They both had family in the title though. But they're supposed to be like three of the highest church offices, like councils. No, women couldn't get to. These were all men, but now there's one woman. Yeah, they just changed it. This happened within the last year. I think it happened just after the last conference. Within the last 6 months, this has happened, I think.
Okay.
Maybe a little bit further out. But it's just funny because, like, they use this as saying, look, women are leaders.
Right.
But they're not leaders. Yeah. It's a smokescreen. It's like, yes, they're in the council, but they're not the ones making decisions. Their voice might be heard, but they don't have any decision-making capability.
They don't have any authority, you know? Really.
They can share an opinion, but they don't have any authority after that. Right. You know? It bothers me.
Yeah, it's more of that consolation prize.
Yeah, this is your consolation prize, and this is the way we're trying to assuage women throughout the church. It's like, look, you could be in this council.
Right. Because that is a growing movement, the ordained women movement in the church.
Oh, yeah, that's when it happened. It happened right around the huge Kate Kelly thing.
Oh.
Just after she got excommunicated, I think.
Right. So Kate Kelly was part of the ordained women group that was trying to get women in the priesthood so that they could become priesthood leaders, apostles, that kind of stuff. Yeah. And she got excommunicated for apostasy, which is just fun.
Yeah, especially because she still technically, I think, believes in the church. She just thinks that women should have the priesthood.
Right, exactly. But, yeah, so they've been trying to come up with ways to throw women a bone to kind of get them to stop yelling that they need.
One of those was incorporating women's conference into general conference.
Right, which
even
is
though
just
it's
silly.
A week before.
Yeah, so the women's conference happens a week before the general conference, and has for years, like for decades, really. Mm-hmm. Right, it's always been the Saturday before general conference. And then after the ordained women movement kind of got some traction, was starting to get some publicity, especially when they started trying to go to the priesthood session and being kicked out, then they said, oh, by the way, women's conference is now part of general conference.
Yep. And that's when they said 8-year-olds can attend.
Right.
I don't know. The whole 8-year-old attending, I just feel really bad for those 8-year-olds.
Yeah. So nothing is technically different. They just are phrasing it differently to try to make it more inclusive without including anybody any more than they would have otherwise. Yeah.
Yep.
Silly.
It is silly. All right. So I don't have anything else on Nelson. So I'm going to move into Holland now. So again, he talks about mothers, but he compares them to Christ and the burdens that he bore. He specifically uses the words bear, born, carry, lift, labor, and deliver for both Christ and for women. Now, so, what does that call to mind?
It sounds like Christ is giving birth.
Right? Yeah, so he ties Christ to a woman's physical act of bearing a child and nurturing that child. Okay. He goes on to say that maternal love has to be divine. There is no other explanation for it.
He likes to use that argument a lot.
That there's no other explanation for the truths of the Book of Mormon.
Right, exactly. Like that famous talk that was a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Like the whole Book of Mormon story, Joseph Smith story. Mm-hmm. Like there is no other explanation.
Yeah.
Like everything else has been shut down, blah, 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 blah.
Yep.
Therefore, it's true. It's like, well, that's just an argument from ignorance, really. Like if you knock down, well, it's like the for the last 10, 20 years or so, like, you know, more mainstream culture, we've been talking a lot about intelligent design and creationism versus evolution and, you know, whether, you know, they should be taught side by side in public schools and, you know, that whole discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the tactics that they use on the intelligent design side is they try to take down pillars of evolution, poke holes in it, try to make it sound like it's not this credible scientific theory that's been around for 150 years.
Like, why are there still apes?
Right. Asking silly questions like that. Right. Which is funny because, you know, if God made Adam out of dirt, why is there still dirt?
Still dirt, yeah. Apparently Ken Ham, that big creationist guy, has on his website has published that you should not use the argument, why are there still apes?
Oh, good. Yeah, can't have good grief. What a ridiculous human being.
Yeah.
Anyway, but, you know, it's that same idea. Like, if they take down evolution, they think that what will be left standing is intelligent design and creationism. Mm-hmm. But that's not the case. Uh-huh. Like, if you take out evolution, all you're left with is just, well, now what?
Yeah.
Like, where is the evidence for creation and intelligent design? Mm-hmm. You know, because that's really what the argument should be about.
Yeah, you but still need to provide evidence, and they're not.
Exactly. Just because you get rid of X doesn't mean Y,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Right.
All you get is not X.
Yeah, exactly. yeah. Let's see. He also says that knowing that maternal love has to be divine and that there is no other explanation for it, that knowing that should be enough to tell us the impact of such love will range unbearable and transcendent over and over again until, with the safety and salvation of the very last child on earth, we can then say with Jesus, Father, I have finished the work thou gavest me to do. Which, again, on the surface, kind of just sounds well and good.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's not.
Right.
You know, this outlines the destiny of women in church.
Mm-hmm.
You get married, you have babies, you have, you know, they grow up, and the more successful you are as a mother is weighed on how righteous your children are, basically.
Right, which brings to my mind the conversation that I had with my mother that I mentioned briefly at, mm-hmm. You know, our first episode.
Right.
Where we were talking about how I left the church and I told her that I was an atheist,
mm-hmm.
and her response was that she had failed me as a mother.
Yeah.
That was her reaction.
Right.
You know, and that is just, it's terrible. Like,
yeah.
Like, I can't even imagine what she was going through mm-hmm. when she felt that way.
Yeah.
Like, that is just a terrible idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And so he's basically reinforcing that concept, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. My mom did something similar, too. It was just through text message, though. I saw on Facebook, she posted like some quote that was circulating on Facebook. I can't even remember what it was, but it basically made it sound like she was just in a really bad spot, like kind of depressed, and her day just wasn't going so great. And I can't remember how we started texting, if she texted me first or not, but I think I asked her if she was okay, and she said, you know, more or less, not really. And I knew that it had something to do with my sister, Missy, and with me, but I didn't want to bring myself into it. So I just asked, is it because of Missy? Because recently she had just come out to the entire family that she was gay.
Oh, right,
And she, my mom responded with, yes. And then there was nothing, it was just dead. And I was like, is it because of me? And again, it was a yes. It's like, my life decision shouldn't have any like real influence over your state of mind. Like, you can feel sad that maybe I'm not making a decision that you want me to make, but it should not make you depressed.
Right. And that's a reflection of the type of pressure that they put on the members.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of the things that kept me from really acknowledging my doubts for a really long time was just I didn't want to go down that road because I knew what it would do to my family. I knew what it would do specifically to my mother.
Yeah. And that's why I haven't come out specifically.
Yeah. And then it happened.
Yeah.
And it happened exactly like I knew it
was
going to.
Well, and she asked you, didn't she?
She did.
She was the reason.
She cornered me, really.
Yeah.
That was an awkward conversation to have in Sam's Club.
Yeah. In front of a register.
Right, in front of the cashier. Good grief.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway. So basically, the woman's destiny in the church is to have children on earth to raise them. And then as soon as, like, you die, I mean, in Mormon culture, there is an afterlife. You live on for eternity, but a woman's role ends on earth, really. I mean, you don't serve any purpose in heaven. It's not like you have necessarily more children. You already have your children.
Right. You're just making spirit babies, which you don't really
interact
with.
Even that, but they don't even say that in the church, really, that you're making spirit babies.
That was always my impression.
That wasn't my impression. My impression was, if you don't have, like, there could be more spirit children up in heaven waiting for you. That was just because you never had them on earth, but you can raise them in heaven. That's how they get around. That's how they, like.
Oh, I'm thinking more long-term, like after judgment and all that stuff.
I guess there is, like, the whole, if your husband is a god, your role is, again, just have
babies
and populate. Yeah.
Yep.
Basically, that's your role. But you just,
it's
dumb.
It is. And it's completely arbitrary because who decided that you were going to be a woman versus a man anyway?
Mm-hmm.
God did.
Yep. Yeah. A woman just has a reserved seat in the background. That's it. And I just don't see how the church can claim that women and men are equal. that they're equally yoked.
Well, they have to because of social pressures.
Yeah.
And so that's where you're seeing all of this, you know, this wheel spinning going around, mm-hmm. all these mental gymnastics being thrown around, you know, to try to make it seem like they have an answer, mm-hmm. when really they're trying to modernize archaic ideas.
Right.
They're trying to cling to things that they've held to for, you know, since the beginning,
mm-hmm.
and make it seem like it's relevant to our society today.
Right.
But it's not.
Right.
You know, and mm-hmm. hence the scrambling.
Yeah. Also, let's see. Actually, I don't know that he talks about this, but anyway. So, in Mormon culture or lore or whatever, in this religion, they talk about a heavenly mother, having a heavenly mother.
Right.
But they don't go into any details or anything about it. Like, she has no voice.
Right.
She has no opinion.
I don't think there's even, like, a reference in scripture to it, is it?
No. There's not. It's just something that's slowly evolved. Again, it's throwing mm-hmm. a bone out to the women saying, well, right. we have a heavenly mother. You will one day be a heavenly mother.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this voiceless, faceless, unopinionated person is an LDS woman's role model.
Yep.
She is what gets thrown in women's faces all the time.
Yep.
It's just... Yep. It's
because from, abhorrent. You know, the archaic idea that men should be in charge.
Yeah.
That is the ideal woman.
It's patriarchy. Yeah. The whole church is based on this.
Yeah.
Let's see. So Holland winds down his talk with, I think, three stories. The first one, and this story plays into the your mom cornering you and saying that she feels like she failed you as a mother type thing. So it talks about a man who is on his deathbed, and he is absolutely afraid of facing his mother in the afterlife. He's more afraid of facing his mother than he is about facing God because he left the church. And he can't bear the thought of breaking his mother's heart.
Right.
And it just, again, it just shows that a woman's value is placed completely on the success of her children within the church.
Right.
If one strays, you failed on some level. If more than one strays, you are an absolute failure.
Right. And there are people in the church that are in that position, mm-hmm. too. You know,
yeah.
It's like in my family, there are a couple people that have left the church.
Mm-hmm.
In your family, like there's a couple, two people,
yeah.
You know, and that's becoming more and more common.
Yeah.
Because the younger generation is disaffecting from religion in general,
mm-hmm.
but Mormonism specifically.
Yeah.
I heard a statistic recently that Mormons leave the church more than any other church.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
In addition to that, they also tend to become atheists mm-hmm. more than people who leave other churches.
Yeah, that's true. I did hear that one.
Yeah, which I think is just a reflection of the sort of absolutist, all-or-nothing mentality that Mormonism creates.
Totally. If Joseph is a prophet, the church is true,
right.
God is real, Book of Mormon.
Yeah.
It's like one pillar falls, everything comes crashing down, and you don't recover from that.
Right.
Yeah. Most people don't anyway. And, yeah, I don't know. The church just has this glorified version of what a mother should be.
Mm-hmm.
And women can't attain it. They just can't.
Right.
I mean, it's that old mantra. Like, no one is perfect. Just no one is. But the church holds up the women's mantle so much higher than a man's. Men all the time are just talked about how fallible they are. And that's why they need a woman. Because the woman is perfect. But she can't be perfect.
Right.
And just, it's why so many women throughout the church are legitimately depressed.
And that's what I was just about to say. It's like in Utah, like, you know, so many people are depressed.
Mm-hmm.
They fall into prescription drugs, mm-hmm. antidepressants.
Right. That's like, why it's called Happy Valley.
Yeah.
It has the highest concentration of prescription antidepressants.
Exactly.
And most of those are for women.
Because the ideal is impossible.
Yeah. It's absolutely unattainable. Mm-hmm. And she has failed if she cannot reach it. Okay, so the second story, this one is about a homosexual young man.
Mm.
He
This is still Holland's talk?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry. Still Holland's talk. He talks about a homosexual young man who ended up leaving his mission due to this struggle that he had spent years, you know, trying to reconcile or whatever. He still went on his mission, but he was struggling. Holland specifically points out that this man did not commit any sin. He was just sent home so he could deal with his struggle. So this,
which is the church's idea about homosexuality anyway.
Yeah.
Like you just, it's just something you deal with.
Yeah.
You know.
Now.
It's a trial.
Yeah, it is a trial. that's why all of your pleadings for him to change you won't work, because this is your trial. This is your burden to bear.
Which is their newest
Which is
narrative.
Awful to tell people.
It's abusive.
It is so abusive.
It's mental abuse.
It's like, I can't change, but I can't be myself.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway. It's something else we can talk about later.
That could be a whole podcast.
Yeah. So he spends years in complete despair trying to reconcile his homosexuality with the church. Mm. And his mom is involved in it. His parents know about it. And, I mean, Holland specifically talks about his mom because he's talking about mothers. Mm. But so his mother helped him through all of this, which Holland says was more difficult than her 9 months of pregnancy.
I'm glad that he knows that.
Right. I mean, I can understand why it would be a struggle, but it's one of those things that shouldn't be a struggle. But again, right. That's something for another podcast.
It's a struggle
podcast.
Because the church made,
it a struggle. Yeah, the church creates problems that they can't fix.
Right. Yeah, that's the whole snake oil salesman. You know, they invent this idea, mm-hmm. and then invent a cure for it.
Yeah.
You know.
Right. I mean, the story basically ends, the kid more or less just realizes that he's going to be gay, but he can still be in the church, and so he goes back to the church or whatever, and, you know, this is Holland's way of glorifying a woman's effort to, you know, bring her child back into the fold or whatever.
So that he basically just accepts his lifelong celibacy.
Yeah.
Or eternal celibacy, really.
Yeah. One thing that I thought was interesting, though, was Holland specifically says that this young man's sexuality didn't change, which is, again, a departure from previous church doctrine that said that you can change.
Exactly. That's what Boyd K. Packer used to say.
Yep.
Like if you pray hard enough, like, you can essentially overcome these temptations, these thoughts.
Yeah.
Which is another just completely wicked idea.
Yeah.
Abusive.
The third story I don't really want to go into. I didn't find anything very interesting about it.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's basically all I had.
Yeah.
On conference. I mean, I read almost everyone's talks.
Okay.
Yeah. There are a few that I didn't. I read, the newest apostles' talks, which weren't anything great. I know one of them, the Swedish guy that everyone is trying to say this makes the church diverse.
He's not actually Swedish.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he has Swedish heritage, but...
But he's not from Sweden.
Not, I think he was born in Sweden.
Was he?
Yeah. I think he was born in Sweden, but his family lived here for a while. I think they may have gone back and forth a couple of times, and then he served his mission in Sweden. But I think he is legitimately Swedish.
Okay.
Anyway, is it Redland? I think it's Redland.
I can't remember.
But I think he's also the apostle that doesn't have a large family. He only has, it's just his wife and his daughter. And I saw this, that his wife is like a really good lawyer. And so people are holding her up as like, you know, what a woman can be. But again, she's still just supporting him.
Right, she's not the apostle.
It's just interesting. Yeah, she's not the apostle. Also, another thing that was interesting, I think he's the one that talks about being called in to President Monson's office and actually receiving the call. I think in the church handbook, it specifically states that spouses should be involved in any sort of calling that is issued. I'm pretty sure my mom was involved when my dad was called as bishop and high councilman, like went to the meetings and stuff. But apparently the wives aren't involved with something like an apostleship.
In case they say no.
Yeah. But, like, that is just completely mind-blowing because, I mean, it's one thing to become a bishop because your life does take a radical change. Like, you spend a lot more time away from home and dealing with other people's problems.
It's a second job.
It is a second job that you're not paid for. But being an apostle, like, it uproots everything. Like, quite often they're relocated to another country.
Yeah.
And for a woman not to be involved in that decision, especially, like, a career woman, like, her entire life is changing and she was not involved in the decision-making process. Again, it's just, it highlights a woman's role.
Yep.
They just go along with whatever the husband says.
Yep.
It's like, this is happening. I'm going to be an apostle and you're coming with me. Sorry.
Such a happy note.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, cool. So, I mean, it looks like we've pretty much wrapped up everything for conference. Yeah. crazy stuff. Conference is an interesting thing. It's really, really boring to sit through.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really just kind of mind numbing.
Yeah, it's so much easier to go back and read it.
Right. But this conference, there were some fun bits.
The entire thing was completely condescending.
Yeah.
This conference really irritated me.
Yeah.
It's
got some really crazy stuff in it.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, that's our show.
Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Remember, you can email us at circlesquaredpodcast@gmail.com or leave us a review on whatever platform you find us on. You can also check out the show's blog at www.circlesquaredpodcast.blogspot.com. And we will see you next time on the Circle Squared Podcast.
See you later.
No more adios.
No. Maybe they do that every time, though.
I know.